From the Land Grant University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of July, 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Naomi Bloom. She's at TotalFarmMarketing.com. I'll update you on yesterday's USDA Crop Progress Report. And then, in the case that you're thinking about fungicides, and I know you are, I'll bring you some information from the CropProtectionNetwork.com. That's online. You can go check it out yourself about diseases in the corn crop and the soybean crop right now. Surprisingly, none to speak of. There is some tar spot around. We'll detail some of that as we make our way through this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report, and then finish up by talking to Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, about the forecast. It's a hot one for a large part of the Corn Belt over the next week or so, right here on Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
September corn for the day settled at $4.43¾, 5.5 cents higher. December at $4.64 a quarter, the new crop up 6.5 cents. March corn, $4.79, 6.5 cents higher. September soybeans, $11.87, up 6. November, 5.5 cents higher at $11.97¾. Bean meal, $3.30 higher. The bean oil, 83 cents higher for the day. Wheat futures in the soft red. The December contract at $6.33¾. Quarters up 5¼. The hard red December, 6.67¼, 3 cents higher on the afternoon. Live cattle futures for the day finished the nearby contract at 238.42½, down 67.5 cents. Feeders at $360.65 per 100 pounds, and they finished 15 cents higher. Lean hogs at $96.92½. Down $1.60. Crude oil trading at $70.55 a barrel, up $2. Diesel fuel just about 800 slower at $3.37. And the wholesale price of gasoline at $2.95½ per gallon on the RBOB, that in Chicago. Naomi Bloom from TotalFarmMarketing.com now joins us out of West Bend, Wisconsin. Hello, Naomi. Thanks for being with us again today.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I'm wondering, from your perspective, can you tell me a bit about yesterday's trade, and then if we had follow-through, or very much follow-through, in the overnight and today trade today?
Yeah, so with Monday's market action, prices were higher on ideas of hot and dry weather forecasts. There were rumors of China buying U.S. beans yesterday. And then also we had technical buying on the November beans. In the middle of the night, the November futures were able to climb through the 40 and 50-day moving average. That triggered some additional buy stops and just technical buying. Corn followed along higher just because of that hot and dry forecast as well, along with corn just being so oversold heading into 4th of July weekend. So today we had the market doing just some two-sided trade action. The market's still supported on the hotter and drier forecast, but we're approaching some significant resistance points on charts. So the November beans are getting close to that $12 area. Back in May, that was big resistance for a good week. On December corn, 470 is significant resistance for that contract. We finished 464 and a quarter today, and 470 is a 50% retracement. There's a few moving averages at that level that may hold as resistance. So going into the latter part of the week, I'm kind of feeling like trade is going to be cautious. The recovery bounce that we've had so far, I feel, is very worthwhile. But for prices to go higher from here, we need a bullish USDA report Friday, and then we would have to have significant hot and dry weather forecasts continue throughout the end of July.
If USDA's report Friday comes out as the trade would expect it based on the acreage and grain stocks updates, and you can tell me what those might be, what happens to this marketplace?
Well, my bias is that if the report comes out as we're sort of expecting, that we'll go back quickly to weather trade. So the report I'm expecting to be primarily neutral. So they'll use the June 30th acres numbers. So that's no change for corn. And then they'll use that slight increase of acres that we had from the June 30th report for the soybeans. But I don't think the USDA is going to make any yield adjustments because so far the crop is okay. We don't have a reason to see them increase yield because if you look at the good to excellent category on crop progress readings, we're just a little bit behind last year, But they don't have any reason at this time to make the yield lower because we are overall, for the moment, doing just fine with our crop readings. So I'm expecting the report to be actually pretty neutral. We'll see if the USDA does any tweaking to the demand side of things. But if the report comes in just as expected, and if by chance they put a little rain in the forecast or they make the temperatures a little cooler, then it is normal after the July WASDE to see prices slide back lower. Actually, I look back 20 years on individual December corn charts. There were only 3 years in 20 years that corn futures have rallied past the July WASDE. 2011 and 2012, of course, we were dealing with tight carryout and then the drought. And in 2018, there was a mini rally after the July WASDE into early August. But then in August, corn prices fell lower and prices then took out all of the gains that it had had in July. So just really be cautious heading into this report Friday. If it's neutral, if it's as expected, if the weather forecast goes back to be a little bit more beneficial for the crop, this little recovery bounce might be a great opportunity to get those old crop and new crop sales made.
I have a nephew who calls me Toddy Bear. Dan Swicker always thought that I was bearish. Both of them are correct. I tend to be about a month too early, but scale upselling is something that I personally ascribe to for myself on making sales. And I look at like this week and think about the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimate Report coming out on Friday. In my perspective, I'm thinking, well, $12 beans seems like a decent place to make a catch-up sale if you've not made enough or to scale in again. Corn is an interesting function. I'm not sure what to do with it because of the diversity or between those two. I mean, soybeans are higher priced than corn is. And I'm wondering what you're telling producers, because many will look at it and say, I want to see what the WASDE report says before I do anything. And I'm always more cautious than that.
Yeah, my thought is that we're probably going to see the prices, you know, stay at these firm levels into that WASDE report. I would encourage some sales ahead of it. I would look at some short-term puts just to protect the rally that we've had, especially if you have any unpriced bushels for old crop. And, you know, $12 beans, we were here for 1 week in May at these prices, and then it evaporated. So China bought, maybe, you know, we're waiting for confirmation, but now we have outpriced ourselves to the world market with this rally that we've had over the past 2 days. So for China to come back in a significant value, I feel like we'll need to have prices fall a little bit lower, and then we'll see them gobble up our supplies.
Now follow up with the corn, because I'd like to hear what you're thinking there.
Yeah, so with corn market, again, just wanting to stay a little bit of a defensive posture for now. There's a lot of corn that still needs to come to town. There is the potential for another big crop that's going to be harvested here in a few months in the United States. The second crop corn in Brazil is about 25 to 30% harvested, so they'll be ready to export that to the world. So I'm of the tone of being defensive at this point. Mother Nature is the only thing that would make me change my tune. Of course, she is ultimately in charge, but seasonals would suggest after this WASDE report on Friday, it's a very good opportunity for prices to slide back down. So take advantage of the rally that we've had.
Anything that livestock producers should be aware of given the heat that's coming into the western United States in the next week?
Well, it'll be something to keep an eye on those cash market values. We're watching not only cash, but just keeping an eye on box beef values from the standpoint of consumer demand after 4th of July. So we're all aware that heat will take its toll on the livestock, and sometimes they slow down some of those auctions just because they don't want to have to transport some of the cattle in the heat. But we'll see how it affects grazing lands, and how it maybe affects grain prices in the future here too as well.
Hey, thank you much. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
That's Naomi Bloom. She is with TotalFarmMarketing.com. This week, we'll begin to use the Crop Progress Report from USDA NAS, the National Agricultural Statistics Service, following the planting progress is important in the spring. And then it begins to correlate, that is, the crop progress as it's related to the conditions report in the month of July, with what final yields might look like. This week, the nationwide corn crop is moving ahead of its historical pace. Corn silking is reported at 16%, ahead of both last week's 9% and the five-year average of 14%. Corn in the dough stage has reached 3% nationally, slightly above the five-year average of 2%. Crop conditions remain steady, with 67% of the nation's corn rated in good to excellent condition. Soybean development is also showing strong momentum across the major producing states. There are 18 of them. 34% of the soybean crop is blooming, up from 19% last week and outpacing the five-year average of 28%. 9% of the crop is now setting pods compared to the historical average of 6%. Nationally, soybean conditions are rated 64% good to excellent. And the winter wheat harvest is progressing rapidly. Producers have harvested 59% of the winter wheat acreage nationwide, jumping from 48% last week and running well ahead of the five-year 51% harvested number. The remaining crop conditions are lower, coming in at just 26%. Good to excellent. Now, here are some of the differences that we find in the key states. In Illinois, corn development is significantly advanced. Corn silking, 43%, running 24 percentage points ahead of the state's five-year average of 19%. In Nebraska, soybeans are blooming rapidly at 49%. Substantially higher than the 33% historical baseline, and in Minnesota, soybean blooming sits at 41%, 12 percentage points ahead of the five-year average of 29%. South Dakota soybean progress is double its normal pace with 33% blooming, and in Iowa and Kansas, soybean blooming is also ahead in both states, with Iowa at 37% versus 31% on average, and Kansas at 26%. Versus 20%. From the Crop Progress Report, we'll move to the Crop Protection Network. This is operated by the land-grant universities and tracks diseases in major crops like corn and soybeans. We'll give you an update from it, and you can find it, by the way, to look at these updates on your own anytime you'd like at cropprotectionnetwork.org. For the diseases of corn, we'll start with southern rust, only reported in a few counties in Texas. Tar spot has been reported in Illinois, but in just one county, Clark County. And in nine counties, spread mostly across central Indiana to the east and just north of Indianapolis. Again, with all just reporting one instance of tar spot. In each of those counties, there was one with two. Two of the nine counties, by the way, are west of Indianapolis. Those are Tippecanoe and Montgomery. 10 counties in Iowa are reporting tar spot, and there are many counties in the eastern half of Nebraska and then along the Kansas-Nebraska state line that have also reported tar spot. Soybeans are clear throughout the Midwest with the exception of one report of red crown rot in each of the following Illinois counties: Adams County in the western part of the state and Hamilton County in the southeastern part of the state. You may learn more and look it all up yourself if you'd like. Check out the Crop Lookout Map at cropprotectionnetwork.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Our theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Let's talk about dicamba now. Harvest Public Media took this subject up and talked with folks right here on campus at the University of Illinois at Purdue and farmers in the east central part of the state. Dicamba is a herbicide that US EPA has been regulating, like all others, for a very long time, but this one has particular issues, as you'll hear from reporter Will Bauer, with drift.
On Kevin Johnson's farm in eastern Illinois near the Indiana border, weeds can be a really big issue. He and his family grow corn and soybeans, and they care a lot about the soil. Instead of tilling the field to kill weeds, Johnson relies on a mixture of herbicides, including dicamba.
We have to have every tool in the toolbox. Weeds are not getting easier to kill.
Dicamba is a potent weed killer, but the problem with this herbicide is that some crops are extremely sensitive to it. Grapes, tomatoes, and some trees can all be killed. Even soybeans and cotton that have not been genetically modified are at risk. Dicamba can drift in the wind, and after it's been sprayed above a certain temperature, it can vaporize and travel for miles. Aaron Hager is a weed science professor at the University of Illinois.
It's never really a question about if we'll see the symptomology of off-target movement. We just don't know how extensive it'll be because we can't really predict what the temperature is going to be.
And that's why Hager says dicamba can be such a contentious topic, even among farmers.
You know, the dicamba mindset among end users or non-end users was like the 2016 presidential election. You were in one camp or the other, and if you weren't in my camp, you were wrong.
The EPA calls the new regulations for spraying dicamba on cotton and soybeans the strongest ever. Hager says in some ways they are stricter. For example, they don't allow dicamba to be sprayed if it's hotter than 95 degrees. But the EPA also dropped rules that prevented it from being applied after June. Purdue University weed scientist Tommy Butts says farmers need to control weeds, but he has mixed feelings about dicamba.
We have to do certain strategies to reduce drift, which are really important, but then that's also shooting our weed control in the foot, and so we're losing here too. So that's why I say I always have a love-hate relationship with it right now, because we're stuck in the middle with a lot of balancing acts, and there's no good answer across the board.
Even outside the agricultural community, dicamba can be a problem. In some rural towns, the signs of dicamba drift are apparent if you know where to look.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
In a public park in Tilden, Illinois, Kim Ernpitcher has noticed the leaves on the bur oak trees are curled and cupped around the edges.
They're also just misshapen. You can see that even some of the tips are folded and some of them are severely stunted.
Ernpitcher is the director of Ecological Health for Prairie Rivers Network, a conservation nonprofit. She's been documenting drift damage across Illinois for 9 years now. She says dicamba stresses trees and even kills others. Previous iterations of the EPA rules, called labels, have been shot down in federal court, and Ernpitcher doesn't expect these new rules to break the cycle.
Over and over, the courts have dealt with this issue, and we've had extremely technical, long labels to follow, and it's still causing injury, and it's really frustrating to see it come back.
Back on the farm in eastern Illinois, Johnson says he's sympathetic to those with concerns about dicamba. He and his neighbors plant dicamba-resistant soybeans in adjacent fields to avoid drift problems. To him, the key comes down to communication.
And I think we're getting better to that, but up until that point, I don't think everybody was having a conversation. We wave at each other, stuff like that, as neighbors, but you got to have those conversations. Nobody loves those conversations, but you got to have those conversations.
Johnson says he wishes there was a better chemical to use, but for now, they have to work with what they have. I'm Will Bauer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of newsrooms across the Midwest and in the Great Plains. Now let's continue with the Closing Market Report, a collaboration of Illinois Public Media and University of Illinois Extension. We'll turn our attention to the weather forecast. Don Day is here. He is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Don, I hope you had a great 4th of July holiday weekend.
I sure did. Hope you did too.
I did indeed. Let's talk about other hot things. July 4 was hot and rainy here. However, I have a feeling you're going to tell me about some really hot weather that may not have any rain in it for the forecast in parts of the Corn Belt, maybe the western parts of the United States. What do you see for the next several days?
Yeah, what we're going to see is I'd call this the first real bona fide heat dome for at least the central part of the U.S. We've seen some here, as we know, along the East Coast and parts of the Southeast with the heat we saw over the 4th of July weekend. But we're going to see a pattern set up where a big high-pressure ridge is going to be forming, centered mainly over the northern plains of the Dakotas by late this weekend and early next week. And then it's going to migrate eastward and set up shop right over the northern Corn Belt. I would say the center of it's going to be in the Iowa, Wisconsin, northern Illinois area, and it is going to make it sizzle. We're going to see triple-digit temperatures from eastern Montana through the Dakotas into Nebraska. That's going to also spread heat where you'd expect it to be hot, but some of the heat they haven't seen yet this summer from California and the desert states. And once this high pressure ridge gets set up, especially during the second half of next week, it's going to make for some dry conditions for several days for the central and western areas of the Corn Belt. So we need to be ready for that. Around the high pressure ridge, and we call this a lot of times the ring of fire, there will be deep moisture circulating clockwise around the high, which is actually going to increase some chances of rain in the drought-stricken west. It's also going to draw moisture in from the southeast Atlantic and Gulf Coast region into the southeastern United States. So we're going to have an island of heat and dryness surrounded by a circle of rain.
Wow, so we have some interesting things happening. The triple digits, those are actual temperatures. Those aren't feels-like temperatures.
Those are going to be the actual temperatures, yeah. I mean, we could see temperatures 105, 108, 109 degrees in those western high plains because of the intensity of the high. Now, the good news for those folks is that it's going to be 4 to 5 days of misery, then it should ease. But at the same time, we're going to see that high go into the center part of the country. So it's going to be making some headlines, and it's going to be impactful.
This one is a little further north than these kinds of highs that I think we have dealt with in past years. Usually I think about them oscillating between the Four Corners and maybe Missouri, Kansas. This one's centered a little differently.
Yeah.
Do we know why that's the case, or is it?
It's counterintuitive. Okay, and this is something that's been going on at the higher latitudes all spring and now into early summer. We have deep storm systems that keep forming in the Gulf of Alaska, off the coast of British Columbia and Alaska. And that is causing the intensity of those storms, which is making that part of the world cold and wet, is causing what we'd call a high amplification of the jet stream, causing the jet stream downwind of these storms to curve much further north than you'd expect them in July. Now, that's one reason why there will be a life cycle. There will be a lifespan on this heat wave to where it will sort of extinguish itself and go through a life cycle. But this is crazy. While we're going to be talking about these triple-digit temperatures, they're going to see unseasonably cold weather and even snow in parts of Alaska during the same period of time.
Wow. When you say there will be a life cycle, is it a shorter life cycle? And does it? And how long do you expect this to oscillate? For instance, do we go through the end of the month? Does it go a couple of months?
Well, I think the extreme heat is going to be about 5 to 7 days. So there's going to be some legs to it. But what you do tend to see is, you mentioned the oscillation, which is typical, you know, going from that Four Corners region to the Southern Plains back and forth. I think what we're going to see is that there's going to be that oscillation, but it may be more north-south than east-west.
Oh, interesting. Well, we will catch up with you next week and see what it's doing then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather. He is in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joined us on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at WILLAG.org. I'm Todd Gleason.